From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today, we'll learn about Milwaukee's affordable housing landscape and why the shortage has been decades in the making. Then, we'll learn about the history of the Brown Berets in Milwaukee and how the local chapter regrouped in response to a rise of hate groups.
We felt that it was important to organize and regroup and be there as a way to reassure the community that they weren't alone, that we were there to protect if needed and help in any way we can.
Plus, we'll hear from a member of Diverse and Resilient about the work they're doing to achieve health equity and improve safety for LGBTQ+ people.
We can't draw back time, right? We can't undo things as badly as we want to. So how do we hold people that have already been harmed and then also make sure it never happens again?
Lake Effect is next, but first the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for joining us. Every year, Milwaukee organizations create about 1,500 affordable rental homes, supportive housing homes, and affordable homes to buy under the area median income. That's according to the Community Development Alliance. However, the pandemic has only exacerbated the need for more affordable housing that's been evident long before the shutdown. There's also a significant racial equity gap in homeownership, and over half of households in the city are spending 30% or more of their income on rent alone. The city of Milwaukee is currently deliberating how to spend the first portion of federal money available through the American Rescue Plan Act. Brian Sonderman, executive director of Milwaukee Habitat for Humanity, is advocating that the city invest $120 million of these funds to increase access to affordable housing and home ownership. He joins me now to share why.
Well, right now, the city of Milwaukee, and really the region, is faced with an affordable housing crisis. We've known about this. It's been decades in the making. But right now, one out of three Milwaukee renters spends over 50% of their income on housing. And regularly at Milwaukee Habitat, we see hardworking Milwaukee families spending 50, 60, even 70% of their income on housing, which means they have very little left over for everything else needed in life. And the pandemic, which the American Rescue Plan was designed to help people and communities through, was really exacerbated that problem. And so we do believe that affordable housing should be a major priority in terms of the investment of these funds so that it can make a generational impact.
What are some of the other factors that have contributed to this housing crisis? You mentioned lots of your wage allocation goes towards rent. Is the stagnation of living wages contributing to this as well?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, affordable housing in Milwaukee, it really has two major aspects. The first is low wages, and we have that throughout the community, especially in a lot of central city neighborhoods in Milwaukee, where incomes haven't matched certainly the pace of other areas around the country. But we also have rising housing costs. And so what we're seeing is that the rental costs in neighborhoods like Harambe in particular, where we're at work right now, for a two-bedroom apartment aren't that much different than a higher income neighborhood like Bayview. And so you have high rents comparatively and exceptionally low wages creates a really cost-burdened housing situation for way too many Milwaukee families. So there's a lot of factors, a lot that goes into that, but there's a tremendous need for more home ownership opportunities in the city of Milwaukee.
So what is Milwaukee's current affordable housing landscape? You know, how difficult is it for people to access it or even navigate the system if they're in need of it?
Well, it's become increasingly more challenging as most recently real estate prices have increased. And we've seen that throughout the country. We've seen it in the central city of Milwaukee and a lot of the neighborhoods that we've historically worked in have seen rising real estate values. So that have well outpaced wage increases. Even some of the wage increases that we've seen, the moves for $15 an hour working wages, it hasn't matched with the housing needs. So there's a significant gap in terms of housing, affordable housing units available. The Community Development Alliance recently issued a housing report, and it did some really thorough analysis. And what we're looking at is an approximate 32,000 unit gap that exists for home ownership in the city of Milwaukee. There's a similar rental gap as well, but just on the home ownership side, we're talking about tens of thousands of units that are going to be needed over the next 10 years to meet the current need of the community. And so it's a big undertaking. And that's why these American Rescue Plan dollars, which is sort of a once in a generation opportunity the federal government has provided the city of Milwaukee, it's an opportunity for us to make an investment, a down payment, if you will, towards addressing this problem.
So you're a nonprofit. Would this money, obviously it's allocated towards a city, but then is it used in partnership with nonprofits or with other city organizations?
Well, what we're thinking is that, you know, there's no one organization that's going to be able to tackle this huge problem. And the city of Milwaukee has a number of departments that oversee programs that are designed to help. For instance, there's down payment assistance grant opportunities through the Strong Home program. There is other help for repairs for owner occupants of their homes and to make those grants available. But then there is going to be the need for other organizations outside the city of Milwaukee to develop new units, whether those are rental units or, in our case, the construction and the rehabbing of homes to provide for home ownership for low to moderate income families. So the city receives the funds. They can use those internally for programmatic needs, but there's also going to need to be a significant investment in other developers, both nonprofits and for-profit developers, to address this huge need.
So where do you feel there is room to grow or fill or repurpose existing properties for affordable housing throughout Milwaukee?
Yeah, so when I look at the housing landscape, one of the major assets, frankly, that the city of Milwaukee has is a really significant inventory of tax foreclosed homes. It's an unfortunate situation that's occurred over time. The city has taken these homes back because of property tax, real estate tax foreclosure. They've held them in some cases for many years. They've been boarded up and in some cases blighted for quite some time. And they're a drain on city resources. But they're also an asset that could be, if those homes were rehabbed and they were made available on an affordable basis to first-time homeowners who low to moderate income, that could be a significant game changer. And the city at any one in time has, you know, 500, 600, 700 properties scattered throughout the city that could be redeployed. No longer on the asset inventory of the city's books, but become, you know, owned by families, paying back property taxes, supporting all the other needs of the city. So that's one asset that's needed. The other asset that the city clearly has is in a number of neighborhoods is vacant lots because of previous demolitions of homes that were deemed to be beyond repair. There are vacant lots that are scattered throughout especially the north side of Milwaukee. And that's certainly where Milwaukee Habitat has partnered with the city to purchase those lots and to build new construction homes. So when I think about the rehab potential of existing city-owned homes and turning those into productive, affordable units that are now able to be back on the tax rolls, that's a positive. Another asset are those vacant lots that could be built upon. And the other thing that I think the city has is both a base of nonprofit and for-profit developers that I believe are ready to go. And I think that the key of and benefit of that is those are all opportunities to hire people from the city, to employ people in the work that needs to be done. The whole housing ecosystem has great potential to produce long-term jobs, well-paying jobs. It's really an issue that if tackled intentionally, there are assets to build upon to begin to address, again, this huge crisis.
So do you think it's such a big crisis that there isn't necessarily a more effective means, you know, like restoring a home versus totaling and rebuilding, you know, just the fact that there is such a need that any and all methods would be effective at the moment.
Well, I think, you know, when you have a big problem, whatever it is in society, very rarely are you going to have one solution. I think we have to look at this as there are a lot of different solutions that are tried and true and tested and should be deployed. We believe that rehabbing existing homes is certainly part of that strategy, but there is a strong need for new home construction. We're the largest home builder that builds homes under $200,000 in southeastern Wisconsin. So there's just a real dearth of people, organizations, entities that are building good quality homes for under $200,000. And our homes generally are selling for between $100,000 and $115,000. So these are 3 and 4 bedroom new homes between 1,200 square feet and 1,500 square feet, 3 and 4 bedroom homes that can really fit the needs, the housing needs of many, many Milwaukee families. So while we can rehab homes, we do believe that it should be paired with new construction because we need to continue to rebuild our housing stock. We have a very old housing stock in general. In Milwaukee, in many neighborhoods, the housing stock, the average, most of the homes were built well before World War II. And there are many, many homes that were built before 1900. And so we need new housing stock. And so I think it's not either or, it's both and.
So you're proposing $120 million for this. Where are you strategically with that? When do you know when this would be approved?
Well, it is being debated over the next 2 weeks, we think is really, really critical at the Common Council level. A number of plans around a number of spending priorities are being submitted and discussed and debated internally by the council. As we understand it, the plan is by as soon as October 21st, many of these priorities being voted upon. And allocations being made of a first tranche of the $400 million. So approximately $200 million has been received by the city of Milwaukee, and they want to have those dollars deployed as soon as possible. And so the decision that will be made this month in October is around how to allocate that first $200 million. And then a second $200 million will be received early next year. And again, the Common Council and the mayor will work together to come to an agreement around that. So the $120 million is really for the both tranches that we're looking at. So we're hopeful in talking with older people from throughout the city that there is a strong consensus that affordable housing should be a priority. Obviously, there are a lot of needs throughout the community. Housing is just one, but we really believe that this is one of those sort of generational times when we've known about this issue, we've seen it, we live in communities that are deeply impacted by it, and now is the time to really prioritize this with some intentional strategies that will have not just an impact for the next 6 months or the next year, but housing has that type of truly generational impact because we're talking about a house that will be in existence for decades to come. You know, thinking about the families who move into those homes, the children who grow up in those homes, the better outcomes that they will experience through their parents owning a home versus rental and moving around from school to school and so forth. So, you know, that's why we think this is a highly strategic time. So, you know, we're definitely encouraging people who care deeply about affordable housing, think that this should be prioritized to connect with their older person and just say this as a constituent, this is a value of mine and something that we would like you to prioritize in the use of these American Rescue Plan dollars.
Brian Sonderman is the Executive Director of Milwaukee Habitat for Humanity. You can find a link to Milwaukee's collective affordable housing strategic plan by the Community Development Alliance at WUWM.com. Coming up in about 20 minutes, a local luthier explains what it takes to keep string instruments in working order. But first, we'll learn about the history of the Brown Berets and the work they're doing in Milwaukee. That's coming up on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. The Brown Berets is a national organization that emerged in the late 1960s. They are most known for their social advocacy around farm workers' struggles, educational reform, and fighting against police brutality. Their recognizable berets with a yellow patch and brown uniforms continue to be a symbol of fighting for civil rights within the Latinx community. The Brown Berets are an active national organization. After hiatus, the Milwaukee chapter reorganized and is now active in the city again. Maria Cruz is a retired educator who is also helping document the oral histories of the Brown Berets in Wisconsin for the Wisconsin Latinx History Collective. And Bernie Gonzalez is the recruiter for the Wisconsin Brown Berets. They both spoke with Lake Effect's Mallory Chang about the history of the organization in Milwaukee and the Brown Berets' work.
Thank you so much, Maria and Bernie, for joining me here on Lake Effect to talk about the Brown Berets of Wisconsin. Just to start right off, Maria, tell us about the history of the Brown Berets. How and when did the group organize?
Well, I guess we really do have to start in LA because that's where the movement began. The founding, they were youth, but of course now they're older gentlemen. But the one specifically is David Sanchez and Ralph Ramirez and Carlos Montes. And at that time, they were, as a woman of 82, I can tell you right now, they were just kids, but they were kids with a vision. And they started a movement, is what they did. And it spread. It spread throughout the country. The first places it was in the Southwest, but then it really hit hard in the Midwest. And places such as Kalamazoo, Michigan, and Kansas City, And of course, Chicago, you know, a big place. And then, of course, Milwaukee. And I would say in the mid to the end of the 60s when the movement took hold here. But the movement here in Wisconsin, it isn't so much that it was different. It was still part of the, you know, overall national scene. But the thing that made this particular unit of a group of Brown Berets is that most of them came up from Texas through the migrant stream. And even those that were, let's say, born here in Milwaukee, even those, many of them, if not most, actually would work in the migrant fields up north here in Wisconsin. That was a common experience that they had. The other common experience that they had is most of them were Tejanos. Tejanos, of course, are Mexicanos. Some of our Brown Berets had always been Texans. Their families had always been Tejanos, long before Texas was part of the United States. So that they have that in common. But the other thing that they had in common was this passion that they had for service to others. It generated, we say in Spanish, un pudor, you know, a strength that they had, which they brought to the ranks. They were organizers. Many of them were official organizers. By official, I mean their job was to organize here in the state of Wisconsin and specifically Milwaukee. Some of them even had special training. Some of them went to training in Chicago. And then they were under the tutelage of their leader, Ernesto Chacon. And at that time, the Brown Berets were, not only were they organizers trained, either in an institute or by their leader, Ernesto Chacon, but they were given responsibilities. They were, for example, in the marches and the demonstrations, they were the vanguard. Their business at that time was to take care of the marchers. They're the ones, they were the front line. So they all took a pact that that is what they would do. They would put themselves on the line for others.
You've been recording the histories of the Brown Berets in Wisconsin through oral histories and conversations. From your conversations with those veterans, what were they primarily advocating for in Milwaukee in particular?
They were looking for justice, first of all. They were looking for social and economic equality because that wasn't the case for Mexicanos, for Hispanos, for Latinos here in Wisconsin at the time. One of the big issues was the marches dealing with migrant issues. They became very much involved personally, and some of them even participated organizing those marches. you just don't, from what I'm told, you just don't get up and march one day. You know, you need to organize. You need to reach out to your community. You need to know who your people are. You need to know what individual can do what at what time. And you need to have a sense of charisma, a sense of making other people take on your cause, their own cause for that matter. So in a way, they were advocates. Not only were they organizers, but they were advocates. They are soldiers on the ground trying to correct wrongs in their own way. Those of us who dwell here in Wisconsin, for example, UWM, if it hadn't been for the concerted efforts of the, specifically in this case, the Chicano people, in conjunction with other groups, we're talking back in the 60s, we wouldn't be talking about UWM. There were only a handful of Latino students. It was decided that this had to end, that there had to be more to be done in order to bring more students. The administration would not listen to the plight and the concerns of the Latino people. So under the auspices of LAUCR, the Latin American Union for Civil Rights, and the efforts of the Brown Berets and others, a tremendous effort took place in which there was actually a takeover of the chancellor's office in UWM. That was a big undertaking to be done at that time. One of the reasons why I'm here today living in Milwaukee is because my husband at that time came over as one of the first Chicano professors at UWM, due primarily to the foot soldiers on the ground who took over the chancellor's office. Some of them were arrested. So they took over the chancellor's office and they started to make demands. At first, they wouldn't listen to them, but little by little, they did. As a result, we now have the Roberto Hernandez Center. So it took the courage, it took the tenacity, just the sense of insisting on the equality and the rights that we need to have as students. So think in terms of how one generation is the building block for the other one.
Definitely. And we have Bernie here, who is a part of the Brown Berets. The Brown Berets are still an active national group. The Milwaukee chapter in recent years was reestablished. Why did the Brown Berets in Milwaukee decide to restore the group?
Yeah, we started seeing some things that were happening in our community. You know, the political situation kind of didn't help, and it kind of divided the country, not just, the state. And there was, hate groups started coming out, and they weren't hiding anymore. And so this kind of created a sense of fear in a lot of people in our community. So we felt that it was important to organize and regroup and be there as a way to reassure the community that they weren't alone, that we were there to protect if needed and help in any way we can. So that's one of the main reasons we restarted the chapter here in Milwaukee. With the COVID situation, it also made a lot of sense to even be more organized and stronger. So those are all things that, definitely were needed, and that's why we're here.
And even just recently, too, the Brown Berets in Milwaukee and Wisconsin spoke out against a recent shooting where two young girls were shooting victims. And unfortunately, one had passed away. And immediately, hours after the event, the Brown Berets stood on the corner to speak out about it, and with signs saying that the violence needs to end. Bernie, what other issues are the Brown Berets in Milwaukee speaking out against?
One of the things that we immediately started doing is we took on the immigration issue. We did a march. We were marching and making some demands and reminders to the Biden administration that there was a lot of people that were still in the shadows, people that have been here for decades and still not able to work and drive legally here in the state of Wisconsin. And so in addition to that, the kids that were still separated from their families and the kids that were still being held in sort of detention centers throughout the United States. with the, like I was saying, with the pandemic, a lot of our immigrant brothers and sisters didn't qualify for some of the stimulus money. And there was a lot of need in our Latino community. So we partner up with another organization and we were able to help out thousands of families with boxes of food. And so that was a huge accomplishment that we're able to do in the short period of time that we started working.
Bernie, with this history that Maria had talked about with the Brown Berets, as someone who is an active member currently, how do you see the foundational values within your work today, and how are you all upholding the original mission of the group?
We want to hold institutions accountable. We are all about helping our community. Of course, direct service is wonderful, but we also want to focus on systemic change. We want to focus on things that are going to be, they're going to be lasting, things that are going to make an impact for also for future generations.
Maria Cruz is a retired educator who is helping document the oral histories of the Brown Berets in Wisconsin for the Wisconsin Latinx History Collective. Bernie Gonzalez is the recruiter for the Wisconsin Brown Berets. They both spoke with Lake Effect's Mallory Chang. You can hear more stories about the Latinx community in Milwaukee and their contributions to the city by visiting wuwm.com/Hispanic Heritage. A report from the Human Rights Campaign found that 37 transgender and gender nonconforming people were killed last year. That's the highest number of deaths reported in a single year since they started collecting the data in 2013. The campaign also found that deadly violence against transgender people disproportionately affects trans people of color, who make up 85% of the victims. There are groups in Milwaukee working to address these issues and improve the lives and health outcomes for transgender people. Diverse and Resilient is an LGBTQ+ public health agency, and Sisters Helping Each Other Battle Adversity, or SHEBA, is a Black trans women's social group that supports and empowers transgender women. Yante Turner, a Black trans man, is the Inclusion and Equity Coordinator of Diverse and Resilient and a SHEBA facilitator. He spoke to WUWM's race and ethnicity reporter Taryn Powell in June about violence against transgender people and what's needed to create change.
So I was reading the 2019 Trans Community Needs Assessment from Forge in Wisconsin, and Forge is a national trans anti-violence organization based in Milwaukee, and they reported that 1/3 of trans people report discrimination at work, and it's for reasons that include age, race, and sexual orientation. What are your thoughts when you hear those numbers?
So we also did an assessment, and we pretty much came with very similar outcomes, right? That folks who were farther marginalized or held deeper intersections like Blackness, like transness, like being a person of color, like being a person who was like under a poverty line or under an income line. And so this didn't surprise me at all. Milwaukee is the number one or number two in segregation. So I wasn't surprised at the demographics. I wasn't surprised that Black people were being more impacted. And yet you still feel that like denseness of almost like dread, right? Like hopelessness of feeling like what, why, how, when Forge, G-Safe, Diverse and Resilient, like we're right here. And yet all of these things are still happening. In tandem, in unison, simultaneously, right? And so it's all systematic. I am an abolitionist at heart. And so when I look at issues like this, I'm like, this comes from one source, right? This is capitalism. This is patriarchy. This is white supremacy at its best, at its finest, already doing its work, right? That's where we see gender-based violence. That's where we see racism at its core being these isms, these very systematic and very systematically rooted and impacting simultaneously everybody, all of our society. And so trans people get the butt end of this gun every time, get the butt end of liberation every time. Movements right now have made trans folks, Black women, invisible, right? And so when you get trans Black women on the table, this is a two-hitter. this right. is a deficit twice. And I always think about that, like Malcolm X quote, where he's like, you know, the most hated is the Black woman. I'd be like, yes. And then you get Black trans women and everybody finds a way to hate them even more. And so Black people, Black trans folks being impacted, specifically Black women being impacted by not having housing, by not being able to find jobs, that is intentional, on purpose, and it's systematic. We took our own data and we had like employment. We were like asking about sex work. We were asking about violence, healthcare, leadership for folks. And people were like, we don't even have housing. What are you talking about leadership? Employment, I don't have a house. It's like, I don't know. I don't care about having no 9 to 5 and I don't know where I'm gonna sleep. And so it was these trickle down effects that you would see in Forge's assessment and our assessment is that people are not meeting these means of like what we have described as like thriving and surviving or like being a good adult. And we're like, look at these people at a deficit. Look at all these barriers. Instead of actually being like, this barrier is here. It's here because of this. This is the root of the problem. This is the issue. Here's how we actually fix it, right? We get these numbers and we get these data and we see these people in real time and it's heartbreaking. And you get trans folks sitting there being like, I'm not asking you for no handouts. I don't want no charity. I'm asking for housing resources. I'm asking for you to help me with my resume. Teach me how to grant write, right? And so none of it was surprising and all of it is heartbreaking. And I don't stay in heartbreak too long because I know trans Black people. I know Black people. We have a ferocity for survival and thriving and always figuring it out. And so I know Black trans people, especially in Milwaukee, will get it done.
Yante, you said even with resources like Diverse and Resilient, Forge, and more LGBTQ plus organizations doing work in the community, we still see these disparities. What helps Diverse and Resilient and these other groups continue its work?
I want to be super transparent, right? Nonprofits can only do so much. And so what helps is community. Community outside of nonprofits, with nonprofits, whatever that looks like, but community. Because for me, organizations house the work that I do, but they are not my work, right? Like my work is trans, queer, relationship building. My work is Black liberation. It's abolishing any carousel systems and states, right? Like that is the work. And like, you can only do that with other people. And that is also what it is when we're talking about liberating Black and non-Black people of color who are also trans, right? That's also what it takes to be at the forefront of liberation is trans people, co-conspirators of trans liberation, all coming together and being like, no, this is what we need. This is how we should move. Because we can't believe in these systems that are in place to hurt folks, that have been hurting folks, because they don't get no better. We can't just cross our fingers and hope that like the deaths of Black trans people will stop. It don't work like that. And so we need elbow grease. We need people power.
I like what you just said, that we can't just cross our fingers and hope the deaths of Black people stop. And so I think it's important to put numbers to those deaths so people can get an idea of the problem. I read from the Human Rights Campaign that since 2013, 78% of fatal violence victims were trans women of color. And in that same time frame, 66% of victims were Black trans women. What do people, all people, need to do better to address this problem?
So many things pop up into my head of like very literal things. Like, what are we gonna do? Okay, build a food. So build another shelter. Only house trans people, right? But at the root of all of that, what actually has to happen is people need to get a lot more compassionate about other people. At the base of all of that, before we build anything, before we do any more campaigns and initiatives, we have to get at the root of like what is actually happening and where people are lacking, and that is compassion. And I'm not even talking about fully understanding nobody, because ain't nobody asking cis people to fully understand transes. It ain't even y'all stuff to be trying to fully understand and figure it out. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. But to be compassionate, right? To see somebody and be like, regardless of what you got going on, you have inherent dignity. Your inherent dignity gives you worth. Your worth means you are able to have a house. You deserve a house. You deserve water. You deserve food. You deserve a way to sustain yourself. It ain't gotta look like no 9 to 5, but you deserve a way, right? That's inherent dignity. If we gave that to everybody, every person that we have ever crossed in our entire lives, our world would be so much different. So different. An entirely different world. And because we do not do that, because we lack that, it does not matter what we do, if we build another shelter or not. It does not matter how many capacity workshops, another Trans 101 workshop I do. It doesn't actually matter because we're not getting to the root of all things. Because the people asking for workshops are not the people killing trans people. The people asking for assessments and to and to like be at the tables with us aren't the people murdering trans people. And so we're talking to the wrong people. It's us having a lens of like transformative justice, right? Of being like, everybody has worth. Everybody deserves a life that they want, that they need. If we gave that to people, especially trans people, especially Black trans women, they wouldn't die. Like, they wouldn't die. If we gave people compassion, people wouldn't die. So we have to do something that involves kicking us into high drive, because we have no more time to waste and lose. People have died already. People have been murdered already. We need to be doing this in the beginning of like human beings. Like, but man, better late than never. So come on, like, come on with the compassion and all the things. Because any of the other things we do is just Band-Aid work.
And that would just keep the cycle going. Yante, do you have any final thoughts?
I think the last thing I wanted to touch on, again, is how interconnected we all are. Transphobia isn't a trans issue. That is a cis people thing. Like, that is cis people's work. That is heterosexual folks' work, right? That is not trans people's work, and yet we are all interconnected because we are, trans people are impacted, right? So it ain't our work. But if we have to take the grunt, right, if we have to take the wholeness that is transphobia, here we are at the table talking about what transphobia is and isn't. Because cis people and heterosexual cis folks don't get to describe what transphobia is. They get told what it is by trans people, and then they need to their part is figuring out what they do next, right? And so all of our stuff, all of these oppressions, all of these things are woven in together to honor that, to honor intersections. We have to be transparent about who's causing harm, what that harm is, and how we're going to destroy it, how we're going to abolish the harm, how we're going to make sure it never happens again, and the people that it happened to feel compensated for the harm that was caused. And I say compensated, and that sounds like currency, right? Your harm is not worth the currency, and that isn't it. I mean, we can't draw back time, right? We can't undo things as badly as we want to. So how do we hold people that have already been harmed and then also make sure it never happens again?
Yante Turner is the Inclusion and Equity Coordinator for Diverse and Resilient, a public health agency based here in Milwaukee. He spoke to WUWM's race and ethnicity reporter, Taryn Powell, back in June. We'll take one more break and then return with a local luthier who explains why she wrote a book to help teachers and students learn more about violins. That's next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Corinthia Klein is a luthier and the owner and operator of Corinthian Violins in Milwaukee's Bayview neighborhood. She's built and repaired string instruments for a wide variety of players, from professional musicians to young students. And Klein says it's easy to learn to play an instrument without fully understanding how it works. She wanted to share the things she's learned as a luthier that she wishes she'd known as a beginner violinist. So she wrote My Violin Needs Help, a book that shares terms, tools, and care tips to make the violin accessible to everyone, no matter their experience. Klein joined me in August to share more and begins by explaining what motivated her to write this guidebook.
When it comes to violins and repair, I mean, you can put your efforts into practicing and playing well and being a good teacher, or you can put your efforts into building instruments and repairing them. But it's hard to be really good at both. So it makes a lot of sense that the average player or teacher really doesn't know enough about their instrument. The problem comes in when sometimes people just assume there really isn't that much to know. So I see a lot of do-it-yourself repairs that do an awful lot of harm to instruments and actually make for more expensive problems later, when the whole point of somebody trying to fix something themselves was to avoid extra costs. And it backfires. And I see a lot of damage done to instruments that make me really sad.
What are some of the most common, like, well-intended home fixes that you come across?
Oh, a lot of things with glue. People really shouldn't be gluing anything. I mean, the scariest ones are the people who, like, don't understand that, say, for instance, the bridge of your instrument, it's a little piece of maple that's holding the strings up off the front of the instrument. That's held entirely by tension. And there are an awful lot of people who think it's glued there if they call me to find out what glue they should use when it falls over. And I say, oh, no, bring it in. I'll stand it back up for you. I see a lot of, in the industry, and this is going to sound sexist, but we call them dad repairs. We have never seen a mom actually go at something with Gorilla Glue, but there's an awful lot of dads out there who want to do that. So in the dad repair realm, there are a lot of, like, someone will break their scroll off and glue it back on. Or there's even one instance of somebody who was trying to help their child because, you know, they got the instrument in tune and then they glued the pegs in place because they thought that would help. So well-intended, but undoing glue is not particularly fun. And there's a lot of, a lot of information that gets passed down from maybe teacher to teacher, player to player, that aren't good ideas, usually in terms of, like, cleaning your instrument. We've had a lot of problems this year due to COVID with people taking wipes to their instruments that took the varnish right off with any virus that might have been there. So there's a whole lot of things that, you know, if people just understood their instruments a little bit better, we could avoid a whole lot of problems.
Right. So can you explain what your book, My Violin Needs Help, does and doesn't do, and what need you felt you could fill with it?
So it's not a technical book for doing, you know, a lot of real repairs. There are books out there like that already, and there's information online in a couple places that are good sources for learning actual repair work if you have certain tools and certain skills already. I think that's great. The niche that I'm trying to fill that I wasn't seeing represented out there was books for people who would like to know more about their instruments in a really practical sense, but don't necessarily need to know how to do actual things. So there is basic information on there to explain, for instance, like if your pegs are sticking and they won't turn anymore, or if your pegs are slipping all the time, well, why are those things happening? As soon as you know why something's happening, it can help you actually solve the problem. And there are some problems like that you can totally solve yourself. And I explain those things in the book. But there's an awful lot of things that maybe you shouldn't try yourself, that maybe you think you could. But I mostly just wanted to provide teachers and students in particular with a vocabulary. So if something goes wrong with their instrument, they're able to communicate that clearly and understand what the possible problems might be.
Well, there is a general sense of familiarity someone needs to have, especially if they own an instrument. But what is one thing a violin or viola or cello player should know how to do on their own that's considered good general maintenance?
I wish more players actually knew how to put on their own strings. Most players, I know a lot of even professional players who really have never been taught how to put their strings on properly. And there's a lot of wrong ways to do it. And if your strings are put on properly, they actually help your instrument stay in tune and they last longer, and that's all good stuff. But the average player, I think, since they're never taught how to do that, they have an impression that there must not be any trick to it. And if the average player knew how to string their strings on properly, that involves having an understanding of actually how their pegs work, you know, that your pegs are fitted to a particular taper, and that you need a certain amount of clearance underneath the peg on the peg box and all of those things. If you understand how all of that works, then you can know how to put your strings on properly and actually help your instrument work a lot better. And just to have a general sense of what things are good to do, you know, on a consistent basis, you know, to change your strings once a year, to change your bow hair once a year. I usually tell my customers to give their instrument an arbitrary birthday and get it a checkup every year on its birthday, just to make sure nothing's going off the rails or getting strange. You know, these instruments, we're caretakers of them. They have longer lives than we do in the best circumstances. So you want to make sure that for the next generation, it's still functioning properly. So when I'm doing repairs on an instrument, I'm usually looking at them in terms of what's good for that instrument 100 years from now and not just this week.
Right. And there's a common theme that perhaps not all novice players would understand or assume, and that's that you want to keep your instrument functioning well and not necessarily doing all you can to make it look pristine. Can you touch upon that a little bit?
One of the things that I don't think most people understand about violin varnish is that it's integral to the instrument's sound. So when I'm building an instrument, I can actually, if I varnish it badly, I can actually kill the sound of the instrument. It's a strange balance of things on a violin. It would make terrible varnish anywhere else, but the varnish needs to be supple enough that it can withstand a certain amount of dings and abuse because they are handled all the time. If the varnish is too hard, it'll chip. But you also need it to be hard enough to actually protect the instrument properly. So there is something to, you know, the way it looks does impact how it functions. So, you know, you don't want to wear through all that varnish and down to essentially bare wood because varnish has a protective function. You know, in fact, I have a lot of rental customers when they bring their instruments back for the next size up. And I'll always examine it and see if there's any evidence of bad habits. You know, there'll be like scratches in like one small section over and over and over. And I usually remind people that, you know, to break those habits, they have to have them pointed out because they obviously aren't doing that on purpose. But in terms of how instruments look over time, people call me often when they want like an inexpensive instrument. They'll say they want something that's used. And that always makes me laugh because that's just the wrong word. The most used instrument in town would probably be, you know, the Lipinski Stradivari. It's hundreds of years old. It's also millions of dollars. That is really used, but that didn't make it cheaper. So for most people, if they're looking for something inexpensive, they should probably look for something that's newer. And those things tend to look sort of shiny and pristine. But there's a lot of people for whom the look of something that's aged, that looks like it's, you know, 100 years old, that's really appealing. So there's actually a lot of brand new instruments that have been antiqued so that they look old. And that's very subjective. And one of the tricky things I find in my shop is getting people to listen when they're trying to pick out an instrument for themselves, to listen with their ears and not their eyes so much. 'Cause you want an instrument that sounds right for you. But I think one of the things that's kind of cool though about violins in general is any of them can be repaired. It's just a matter of love and budget.
So what's your number one piece of advice when it comes to trying to see how much help a stringed instrument needs?
Well, I mean, I guess the best piece of advice is to just get them a checkup once a year because, you know, someone will catch anything that you're not trained to see. But for the most part, you can trust your ears and your hands. And if something feels uncomfortable or different than you'd like it to be, I mean, that's a good time to sort of ask for help, because instruments are always changing and moving, and, you know, they're very personal and subjective. Everyone's unique because each piece of wood is unique. I guess if I had to say, like, the number one thing that would be nice for people to know is that, like, if they have an instrument that's been in their closet for, you know, 10 years, too many people just assume that it's probably fine just if they pull it out. Whereas it's a mechanical device and it's always changing and adjusting. So, you know, the same way you wouldn't let a car sit for 10 years and assume it doesn't need anything before you try to start it up again. Same thing with a violin or viol or a cello. If it's been just sitting sadly in a closet for a long time, it's still changing and adjusting and moving in there. In that case, it didn't just stay in stasis and is the same as when you left it. It changed. So, you know, be prepared to actually maybe go investigate what it needs to make it be optimal again.
And when in doubt, take it to luthier, right?
Yes. your friendly neighborhood luthier. It doesn't even have to be me. I just want everything prepared for properly.
Corinthia Klein is a luthier, owner of Corinthian Violins in Bayview, and the author of My Violin Needs Help, a repair diagnostics guide for players and teachers. We spoke in August. And that's Lake Effect for today. Thanks so much for being with us. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Tomorrow on the show, we'll look at the redistricting process happening in Milwaukee County, plus learn about a new book for kids called A Smart Girl's Guide, Race and Inclusion. That's tomorrow at noon on Lake Effect, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.